If you don't know what you're doing, you don't know where you are, and you don't know where you're going. And if you're in a place where you don't know where you are or where you're going, you're in danger. Because that's unmapped territory, and God only knows what lurks in unmapped territory. If you're so confused and disoriented that you don't know where you are or where you're going, there are predators of the spirit who are much worse than snakes that are waiting for you. And the probability that you'll move from aimless, hopeless, joyless anxiety to nihilism, corrosive bitterness, and genocidal fantasy in the fundamental extreme is very high.
It's like, well, I just want to be happy. It's a slogan. It's the most common slogan of our time, I would say. And it's such a preposterous slogan. It's like, what do you mean just? You just want to be happy. That's all. That's all you want. That absolute impossibility. You want bliss unending no matter what you do. And that's all you want. It's not exactly a small ask, let's say. Because it's the same thing as asking to dwell permanently in paradise. It's something like that. And then it also isn't true. That isn't what you want. If you do careful analysis of what people mean when they say they just want to be happy, what they mean is they don't want to suffer stupidly. They're much more concerned, we're much more concerned with not experiencing an excess of negative emotion than we are with experiencing a surfeit of positive pleasure. So first of all, we don't mean we just want to be happy. We mean, please don't make us too miserable. And fair enough, that's reasonable. But then even on the happiness front, even on the absence of misery front, that's not true. It's like, it isn't obvious at all that we want happiness. It isn't even obvious that we want absence of misery. What's really obvious is that we want an adventure, right? We want an adventure that's so compelling that it makes the misery of life not just justifiable, but worthwhile. You want to look back on your life, and you know this to be true. You want to be able to say to yourself, even considering a month or a week or a series of days, you want to be able to say, that was really difficult, but you know what? It was worth it. And I think that's what you want from your life. It's something like, you know what? That was difficult, but it was worth it. And that meant that the adventure was so great that it justified the difficulties. And so then the question is, and here's the question, where do you find the great adventure of your life? Well, how about in truth? Well, why? Because you don't know what's going to happen if you tell the truth. It's a mystery. It's going to lay itself out for you. And so that's an adventure, because you literally do not know what's going to happen. You have to let go of knowing what's going to happen. And so then you have that adventure. And then what is also the case is that it's you that's having the adventure. Right? Because if what you're doing is living in truth, that's you. That truth is you. And so that means that whatever happens when you tell the truth is your adventure. And then you think, well, I'm using deception. It's like, well, maybe you are, but maybe deception is using you. And then maybe it's the spirit of deception that's having the adventure of your life. And then you might ask yourself, well, why are you so miserable and unhappy? And the answer would be, well, the spirit of deception is having the adventure of your life. You're not even there. Because if you're not living in truth, you're not there. Obviously, what's there is the spirit of deception. And you might think that's your deception, but I would be very careful about thinking that, because there have been centuries of meditation on the nature of the spirit of deception. And the answer isn't that the spirit of deception is you. The answer is that the spirit of deception is something that possesses you, convinces you that it's you. And that's not something you want to fall into the clutches of. The world is founded on a sacrifice, right? And that's what the crucifix represents. And European towns were built around a church, and the church was built around an altar, and the altar was built around the idea of sacrifice. So the sacrifice, the proper sacrifice, is at the center of the community. That's what that idea means. Now you might ask, well, what's the proper sacrifice? And the answer is something like the voluntary willingness to bear your cross.
And then you might say, well, what is your cross? And the answer to that is, well, that's the catastrophe of your life, right? That's the fact you'll be betrayed, the fact that you're going to die, the fact that you're going to be in pain, the fact that your loved ones will see you suffer, the fact that the mob will come after you, the fact that criminals might be preferred to you, etc. It's all the potential catastrophes of your life. And then the sacrifice is the idea that you have to let your, what would you say? You have to let your narrow ego go enough so that you pick all that up voluntarily, all of that. And then that transforms it. And I think that's literally true. I think that's what all the psychological evidence points to, is that if you adopt a stance of voluntary challenge, even in relationship to tragedy and malevolence, that's the pathway to transcendence.
Do you have something to say that you're not saying? If you do, then it's your fault. This is your fault. It's your problem. And you might say, well, I'm too afraid to talk. It's like, fair enough. How afraid are you not to talk? You know, people say to me frequently, they compliment me on my bravery. And I think, you don't understand. I'm not brave. I don't like conflict. I'm way more afraid of losing control of my tongue than I am of the consequences of saying what I have to say. Because I know what happens when we allow other people to control our tongues. It's not good. It's not good. It's hell itself. And so, of course, it's troublesome to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune when you say what you have to say. It's like, that's fine. Try not saying what you have to say. Well, that'll be okay in the moment. It's like, yeah, in the moment. But unfortunately, your whole life isn't in the moment.
Practice in developing the capacity for skilled movement forward in a manner that simultaneously encourages the others that you're cooperating with to do precisely the same thing. And that's not some arbitrary ethos. It's not arbitrary, because if that doesn't happen, then nothing flourishes. And if it does happen, then everything flourishes. It's also not relativistic in some sense, because you have to do that no matter what you're doing. No matter what it is that you're doing, if you do that well, you're doing whatever it is you're doing well. In fact, that's really, in some sense, how you would define well.
If you give up enough psychologically, you'll cut your losses in actuality. And of course, that's sort of what thought's for, is right? So that you can get yourself straight, you can give it up in abstraction so you don't act out the pathology, and then nothing dies in actuality. But that still means you have something to give up.
You want to initiate a process of active engagement with the dragon that burned you, fundamentally. The psychophysiological pattern of active engagement is the opposite to the psychophysiological pattern of involuntary stress. And so if you can practice embodying that voluntary confrontation, then that stance can come to dominate. And that's the stance you want to dominate, because that moves you forward voluntarily into the world. And so, and that, in all probability, that will work.
I want to be free to do what I want. Okay, well, hang on a sec. Which I are you talking about there? Are you talking about the mature I that sees next week and next month and next year and 10 years out and that takes the community into account? Or are you talking about the impulsive, hedonistic, self-serving, narrow eye that just wants exactly what it wants right now? And what makes you think that when you make a case for that hedonism, that you're not just falling under the sway of an impulsive, short-sighted demon, so to speak? If you look at music, for example, music operates by very sophisticated rules. And so it's ordered and constrained. But out of that rules, system of rules, comes an almost infinite array of possibility. And so, you know, we have this sense, I think it derives from Rousseau, that any constraint of order is a limit on freedom, when what we should be hypothesizing is that with the optimal set of principles, you get the maximally desirable freedom. And it's not freedom from everything, and it's not freedom to do anything. It's certainly not a narrow hedonistic freedom, because that backfires on you like the next day.